This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
In 2018, Kayla Steckline's husband Andrew died by suicide and the news went around the world. The 30-year-old pastor and father of three had taken his own life and many in the Christian community were shocked by the loss and uncertain of how to handle it happening to such a vibrant faith leader. All the while, his wife Kayla was trying to support him and look after their three sons, witnessing firsthand how fear took hold of Andrew's life and ultimately led to his death. It was hard for Kayla seeing Andrew's worst moment become his most recognised across the globe, and in her new book, Fear Gone Wild, she unpacks the disease that caused Andrew so much pain, along with the tenacious faith in God he had running alongside it. Kayla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's such an honour.
Now, what we read in your book is something quite personal to you. Why did you decide to share your story?
Yeah, right away, when my husband died by suicide in 2018, our story just went viral. It spread all around the world. And right away, I just felt this deep desire to rewrite the script. I didn't want the news headline to be "Pastor Dies by Suicide." I wanted Andrew's life to be known by the way he lived, not the way he died. So I chose to speak right away, and I wrote him a letter just 3 days after he passed away. And in the letter, I was full of empathy and compassion for him. I told him how sorry I was that this happened to him. And so I really reframed the way I was looking at the suicide as well. And so really since those 3 days after, I've just continued to write. I wrote him a series of letters. I kind of shared my grief journey. My Instagram feed is really this living, breathing journal. And all of that just really turned into a book. You know, doors started opening and God just made it really clear that this message was so much bigger than I ever imagined it would be. And I'm so honored to have the opportunity to write this book. And my hope is that it really helps a lot of people, that it saves lives, that it keeps breaking the stigma, and that it changes the way that we view mental illness. My hope is that it'll help us view mental illness through a new lens of empathy and love.
And your perspective on the entire circumstance and everything leading up to it, I honestly believe is something that's so encouraging to many. And even in the foreword, Lisa Turkhurst describes your story as one of being both a beautiful love story and also a tragedy, and the importance of being in the middle of those two, bringing those two sides together. What's your perspective on the bridging of the gap between those?
Yeah, it really is. It really is holding the sorrow in one hand and holding the joy in the other hand. My oldest son, Smith, really described this so beautifully. He had this Mother's Day makeover at his school. It was the very first Mother's Day after my husband passed away. And, you know, they have these really cute fill-in-the-blanks for Mother's Day. And so there was one line that said, "I love it when my mom takes me to the cemetery and takes me to Disneyland." Literally the saddest place on earth and the happiest place on earth in the same sentence. And that's his perspective, and that's our life. It's one foot in the saddest place on earth and the other foot in the happiest place on earth. It's choosing joy while also holding the deep pain and loss and grief. It's making space for both. You know, what I've learned in my grief journey is that I'll never move on from the pain. The pain moves forward with me, but I can choose to build a beautiful life around it, and that doesn't take away from the pain.
And we are going to jump into a little bit of how you've been able to do that, because I know there's many listeners who will be astounded at the really sound perspective you've been able to find and truly want to experience it for themselves. So we will touch on that. But I wanted you to tell us a little bit about your husband, Andrew, because we got the headlines here in Australia in Christian communities about what had happened. And there were some people who were aware of your family and aware of your ministry, but then others who just saw the sort of final story, if you want to call it that. Tell us a little bit about him and how you met him.
Yeah, Andrew and I met in college. It was my sophomore year of college, his junior year, and one of my best friends was actually dating one of his best friends, and his best friend's actually from Australia. They actually live there now, so it's pretty cool. So they were dating, and so one day she went over to the beach house that they lived at, and she showed my husband, Andrew, at this picture of her girlfriend. And he picked me out of the picture and said, "Her, I want to meet her." And so I went to the beach house and I brought a friend with me. I was like absolutely terrified and intimidated. And so I brought a friend with me, and right away I was just so drawn to him. He was just different. He was different than other 19-year-old guys. You know, he was driven. He was magnetic. He had a drive for excellence. He already knew what he wanted to do with his life. And like, school was just getting in the way. So he was like already on his career path. And all of that was just so attractive to me. Like, he knows where he's going and I want to go with him. Like, right away, I'm like, I want to go with him. And so we fell in love really fast. Just a year later, he proposed. And the year after that, in December 2010, we were married. And I loved our life. You know, he felt called to ministry. And so we jumped right into ministry, and we had three beautiful boys together. And so life with him was really such a beautiful life. And being his wife, I was so proud to be his wife. He was an incredible man.
And you've really lived an entire lifetime in a window where some people are still just getting started in their 20s and even into their 30s. It's incredible just how much life you've lived in the lead up to that kind of season. But in the book, you obviously also talk about when fear started to affect his life and affect your life. What kind of effect did fear have on Andrew?
Yeah, so the fear crept in the fall of 2017 is kind of when our life started to change. We had a stalker issue in our family, and it really invited this sense of fear for my husband. And that fear manifested itself in panic attacks. And so 3 to 4 times a week, he was having these very debilitating panic attacks that were really terrifying. If you've ever witnessed a panic attack or had a panic attack, then you know that it really is fear gone wild. That's where I got the title from for the book, is that I had heard panic described as fear gone wild. The fear creeps in and it just spreads like wildfire, and it would take over his whole body. I would look him in the eyes and his eyes would be glazed over, and I wouldn't be able to reach him no matter what I said, no matter what I did to help. Like, nothing could touch the raging fear happening in his body, just out of control. And so that was happening 3 to 4 times a week. And we were trying to figure out why. So we were seeing doctors, he was doing blood work, we were doing tests, trying to figure out where these panic attacks came from. And it took months. And so he actually ended up having a massive panic attack that landed him in the hospital in April of 2018. And it was after that that we decided, like, enough is enough. All of the blood work is coming back fine. Like, it's not showing that there's anything wrong with his body. Like, we don't know what's going on, but we can't live like this anymore. So he needs to take a break. And it was just a few weeks later that he was diagnosed with depression.
How did you distinguish between the fear that comes from a spiritual place and fear that is very human and very much triggered by environmental factors?
It was both. For Andrew, it was both. And I include that in the book. There's a whole chapter in the book called Stranger Things, and it talks about the spiritual warfare component that was a major component of his journey. He really felt like he was under oppression from the enemy. He really felt like the enemy was out to get him because of his calling and what he was doing with his life. And it was very real for him, and it was really terrifying. I recount some pretty intense encounters that he had with the darkness in the book. He would see things that he would call creatures that were talking to him and taunting him and torturing him, and he felt terrified. You know, in those moments, he would be weeping and he would be shaking and he would be very terrified. But he was crying out to God and he was running to God in all of those moments, you know, in his fear with his panic attacks, in the fear with the spiritual warfare, in the depths of his depression. Like, he was running to God and I was running to God, and we were begging God for healing. We were begging God for intervention. And it really was just this wilderness season. Like, where are you, God? Why are you allowing this to happen? And it really did feel like fear had just swept my husband away and just had taken over our home. It was a really difficult season, a very difficult summer, and he really struggled. And it was hard for me because I can only see so much. You know, I didn't see the spiritual warfare component that he saw. You know, I'd walk into the room and he's explaining to me the oppression that he's feeling and the things that he's seeing. And I'm looking around the room and I don't see anything. And so all I could do in those moments was pray. When he was having a panic attack, I would pray. When he was experiencing spiritual warfare, I would pray. And It was very, very difficult, and it felt like it had gone wild.
And you are really honest in Fear Gone Wild about the impact of that on you. You're a mum of three. You're trying to lead within a church, love your husband well and support him, pray for him, be both a practical and also spiritual foundation and rock for him. When you're feeling like your prayers aren't having an impact or you're not getting the results that you want, how did you deal with that? How did you find hope and still trust God in the face of what really seemed like such an immovable obstacle?
It was really hard. You know, I was so frustrated with God during that summer. I was crying out to God. I was mad at God. I was wrestling with God. Like, where are you, God? Why aren't you fixing this? Why aren't you intervening? You know, there was one moment just a week before he passed away where I had this really special moment with him, and I was praying over him, and I had felt like, you know, I was doing all I can do to help him. And as soon as I was done praying, he walked outside in frustration. And I remember crying out to God, like, why is he so unhappy? Why aren't you fixing this? What more can I do? You know, there wasn't anything else I could do. I was doing everything I could do. And so it was so frustrating. And God did feel very distant, and it was this dry season in my spiritual life where I was just like, where are you, God, and why aren't you fixing this? And then after he passed away, what was so interesting about that was that after he passed away, it felt like God was everywhere. So I went from where are you, God, to oh my gosh, God is in everything all the time, everywhere. And these little kisses from heaven and these miracles that he was providing were so in my face. But I was absolutely blown away.
Did you find it tough seeing so much of God after something so hard? I mean, I know like there's people listening who, you know, they experience a divorce or they experience some kind of loss or someone passing away, and that's hard, and then there's something good as a result. Sometimes there can be a guilt with that, that there's almost a kind of enjoyment's the wrong word, but a sort of satisfaction that can come after something so hard. How did you feel about that side of things, that you were actually experiencing something good after something so tragic?
Yeah, I think what's so hard for us in our faith journey is wrestling with the fact that we serve a God that allows suffering. He allows suffering. He allows death. He allows pain. He allows trauma. He allows hardship. Like, he allowed this to slip through his fingers. He allowed Andrew to die. He allowed the depression to enter our home and the fear to enter our home. Like, he allowed all that to happen. And so it is difficult. You know, it is a wrestle to be like, okay, you allowed that to happen, yet I still trust you. And then, oh my goodness, look what you're doing. This could only be you.
Yeah.
It is this, it's this mystery, you know, and I've said over and over again in conversations with my friends that I just stand back in awe of the mystery of it all, of the mystery of the journey with my husband, of the mystery of death, and just how death is such an elusive, intangible thing that's still so mysterious to me. I still go sit at the cemetery and I can't fully wrap my mind around even death. And then I sit in awe and wonder of the mystery of life, and that I can still have a beautiful, meaningful life despite the overwhelming pain and despite the great deep loss and trauma that I've walked through. And so all of it is just this mysterious, I will never understand this, but God, I know you were in all of it. Even though I didn't feel you, even though I didn't see your hand in the depression journey, you know, I see you now and I feel you now, and you have been so close to me in my pain. And, you know, that verse, God is near to the brokenhearted and comforts those who are crushed in spirit. Like, that is so true. And I felt that so deeply in my pain. And even my friends, you know, my close friends, I feel like it even grew their relationship with God, just watching the miracles that he was doing in our life that were so clear. And it was so obvious that it was him at work, trusting him through all of it, trusting him in the process and continuing to run with him, even when you're frustrated. Like, even that summer, I was still running to him. Even in all my frustrations, I was still crying out to him, and I was still praying, and I was still worshiping him. Like, we can continue to worship even in the wilderness.
And I think it's such a testament to your faith that you've been able to do that. I mean, you're honest about how hard it has been, but that you've also been able to keep this perspective and keep hope, I think is really encouraging to so many. And even for Andrew, his experience is obviously very specific, and how fear impacted him is quite a personal thing. all of us, I think, have experiences with fear, but it can look different to what Andrew had in his own life. How do you see fear impacting people in a more broad sense? Because I think it'd be really easy for some to brush off the idea that their life is in some way governed by fear if they're not experiencing it to an extreme degree. So how do you think fear impacts the majority of us?
I think all of us, you know, face fear every single day in a lot of different things. And especially right now in 2020 with the worldwide pandemic and COVID and the lockdown and isolation that we've walked through, I think, you know, fear is part of our daily life. We all carry fear with all different sorts of things. And so I think just that awareness. And for me, what's been so helpful is when I am overcome with fear, because I have moments where I'm just absolutely terrified with the future and my life and my circumstance and these hard conversations that I'm having about mental health and suicide. And I'm like, God, I'm not even, what are you doing? Why did you call me to do this? Like, this is terrifying. This is hard. And what's been so helpful to me is just to acknowledge that, like, I'm feeling afraid right now, and I'm not going to shame myself for feeling afraid. I'm going to welcome that feeling. I'm going to acknowledge that feeling. I'm going to release that feeling, and I'm going to ask God to help me. So I'm going to pray for courage. I'm going to pray for strength. I'm going to pray to be brave. I'm going to pray to be bold, and I'm going to, you know, pray that spirit of fear away. But it's welcoming it. You know, I think all of those feelings that we feel, like anger and fear, that can be negative feelings, can also be good for us. I talk about in the book a little bit how fear can be good for us. You know, like, God gave us that emotion for a reason. And there's sometimes where the fear is helpful to us. You know, our adrenaline kicks in and we're able to do amazing things through that fear. So we all wrestle with it. And I would just think an awareness of it, an awareness of when it's getting out of control, and just being proactive about that. Like, okay, I'm having a lot of fear. I'm having a lot of anxiety in this season, and being willing to share that with friends, being willing to share that with your community group, and maybe a mental health professional or your doctor's like, I'm feeling a lot of anxiety in this season. I'm restless. I can't sleep. I'm having terrible dreams. Like, I think being aware of it and calling it out. And of course asking God for help. But then there's other times where it is a real physical thing. Like, Andrew had a real physical illness. It wasn't just this emotional fear. It was a real physical chemical imbalance happening in his mind with the mental illness that he needed medication for. You know, sometimes we need those things. Sometimes we need medication. Sometimes we need medical intervention. Like, those things God gave, those are tools God gave to help us as well. Yeah. So I think just being aware of when it's out of control, and then also just being aware of how it does play a role in our day-to-day life.
And taking some steps to actually remedy it when you do recognize it sounds like a really important part of that equation. And in the middle of this journey, and even in the aftermath, you've got three boys who have been walking this alongside you and were quite young when Andrew did pass away. How did you explain to them what had happened and help them process their really innocent grief?
So I waited a whole week, which might sound a little strange, but I felt like I really just needed some space. It was so shocking and so traumatic, and we really, truly never saw his death coming. And so I just needed some space to process and to talk to the right people. So I talked to some child life specialists. I read some books. I did some research. I actually even went home and I cleared out his side of the closet. I cleared out his shoes from the garage. I cleared out his side of the bathroom. I wanted the information that I was sharing with my children to match the environment, because they're so young and they have such a limited understanding on heaven and hell and death and life and all of it. I wanted our environment to match the information. I didn't want them to think that their dad was coming back. And so I cleared everything out, and then they came home and I sat them down and I gave them each a fruit snack and sat them down and said, hey, I need to tell you something. You know how daddy's been sick? You know how daddy's been going to the doctor a lot and sleeping a lot? Well, daddy did something that caused him to die. And now he's in heaven with papa, and daddy's not coming back. And, you know, that from the child life specialist told us to use the word died and died, and that it was important to use that language because it's such concrete language for them. Not passed away, not fell asleep, that he died. And so it sounds so harsh, you know, for a 2, 4 and 5 year old. And my 2 and 4-year-old just went outside and played, and a lot of kids process through play. And then my 5-year-old went into the kitchen, and he was just so eager to throw away his fruit snack wrapper. And so I followed him into the kitchen. He threw away his fruit snack wrapper, and then he just turned around and I held him and we wept. You know, he understood what that meant because he had just lost his papa a few years earlier, and he knew papa didn't come back. So he knew what that meant and the gravity of it. But what was so special that day was that we spent some time coloring in this little coloring book. And one of the images in the coloring book that was explaining grief and death to children was this image of a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. And so it had like the life stages of a caterpillar. And so we were coloring in this coloring book, and we were talking about life and death and the butterflies and the caterpillars. And then it was time to take a nap. And so I went over to the curtains and I went to pull the curtains closed. And there was this little teeny green caterpillar hanging on the curtain. And we didn't have any windows open, any doors open. Like, I do not know where that caterpillar came from except straight from heaven. And so I pulled this, I like squealed, and I grabbed this caterpillar, and I show my son Smith, and he says, "Mom, that's a miracle from God."
Wow.
It was just so special how in that moment, in the most painful, like that is a parent's nightmare to have to have that conversation with their children. So in the most painful thing I've ever had to do, breaking the news to my 3 boys, like God provided a miracle even that day in the form of a little tiny green caterpillar that my son knew right away was a miracle. So it's just, you know, for them, it's going to be a lifelong journey of grief at every stage as they develop more and grow more and learn more. You know, it's going to be walking them through that. But my heart for them is that they will see the suicide not as something that their dad chose, but more as something that happened to him as a result of the physical and mental illness that he was experiencing. So I hope that they have empathy and compassion for their dad. And that's why I wrote the book too. You know, I wrote the book for them. That way that when they're older, they can really get an inside look of what life was like when their dad was sick, and then what life was like after he died, and how we rebuilt this life together. I think it'll be really powerful for them as they get older.
Absolutely. And I think you come to it all with such a tenderness for your family and for Andrew. I imagine it can't have been easy for you to have to empty out his wardrobe, clear his shoes, and do all of those things in a way that was part of your own process, but also that was for someone else. I think you just, I just am amazed at the way that you've been able to walk through this season. And again, in the book, you're quite honest about an instance where there was a moment where you felt like, and Andrew had opened up to you about his thoughts emotionally and his thinking of suicide. And there was a part of you that thought, this would just be so selfish. How could he leave us? Why would he do that? And there's that train of thought that probably many people would have, even if they wouldn't want to admit it, they would think it was a really selfish decision. But then you were able to change your perspective and see how it's not selfish. It's actually something that, as you've just mentioned, was kind of out of his control. It's not something that he chose to actually do. How did you switch perspectives like that, moving from seeing suicide as an act of selfishness to something that is not chosen?
Yeah, I'll never forget that moment. We were sitting at the kitchen counter, and I reacted to his admission that he was struggling with suicidal thoughts, and my reaction was, that's the most selfish thing you could ever do. I can't believe he even said that. Like, he would never do that to us. And I completely brushed it off the table, and I never brought it up again. And what I've learned, you know, I've learned so much since he died. I think just hindsight is 2020, and I've just been so eager to learn more about suicide and to flip the script on it and to help people to stay and to just help educate all of us. Like, I'm learning so much along the way too. And so what I've learned in my journey of healing and growing and reading is that suicide isn't always, you know, something that you choose. It is the result of an underlying physical illness, and it is a result of pain. It's a pain problem. There's been studies done on people that have attempted suicide and survived, and they have said that the instant that they attempted it, they regretted it. It was instant regret. Because they don't want to die. You know, when someone attempts suicide or dies by suicide, like, they do not want to die. They just want their pain to end. And death seems like the only solution to make their pain end. And so for me, what's been so helpful is, like, yeah, I will never understand the immense emotional pain that Andrew was experiencing. I have no idea, even though I was married to him, even though I shared a home with him, even though I was by his side every single day, I will have no idea what it was like to walk in his shoes, to live in his body, to experience his thoughts. Like, I have no idea. And so I think just stepping back and zooming out and realizing that he was carrying pain. And for him, in that moment, it felt like the only way to make his pain go away. And I'll never forget his psychiatrist telling us after that 90% of suicides are impulsive. It's this in the moment, overwhelming pain that you just want to end. And so death feels like the only solution. And so it's been really helpful for me just to have that perspective. I've even changed my language. So I don't say committed suicide anymore. I say died by suicide. The word committed is a word we use to attach to phrases like committed a sin or committed murder or committed crime. And what that word does is just keep more shame and blame onto the shoulders of the person who died. So that's why the phrase died by suicide is so powerful and so meaningful. Like, that small shift in our language makes such a big difference. Like, I see this as something that happened to Andrew, not something that he chose. It's a tragic accident, a tragic death. Like, no one is to blame. Andrew's not to blame. I'm not to blame. The doctors aren't to blame. The medication's not to blame. No one is to blame. It's a tragedy. It never should have happened. And that's how I'm choosing to see it.
You also speak really, I think, insightfully about how the church relates to conversations around suicide and how people of Christian faith can support people who are going through an experience similar to Andrew's. What would your advice be to church communities in how we can have better conversations about mental health and look after people who are facing challenges better?
Yeah, I would just encourage all of us to remember that mental illness is not a faith issue. It's not a sin issue. I watched my husband run to God in his pain. He was running to God. He was reading scripture. He was doing a daily devotional. Like, he really, truly was running to God in his pain. And he was full of faith. I mean, he was a pastor. He was a leader. He loved God. He served God with his life. But he also struggled with mental illness. And so I think just normalizing that it's a real illness just like any other illness. It's just as real as cancer. It's just as real as having the flu. It's just as real as coronavirus. Like, it's just as real as any other illness, and putting it in that category, and that it's not a faith issue or a sin issue. And that I believe that there are supernatural things that God does, and that there are instances where people are overcome with depression and suffering from panic attacks and struggling with suicide, and they are prayed for, and instantly those thoughts are gone. And I totally believe God can do that. You know, God can do anything. He could do that for cancer as well. But I think as Christians, the perspective we need to have is just to step back and say, I'm so sorry. I have no idea what it's like to feel the way that you feel. I have no idea what it's like to walk in your shoes, but I'm here for you. How can I serve you? What can I do for you? I think embracing and approaching and leaning into the conversation, I think oftentimes the word suicide, the word depression, the word mental illness, the word anxiety can make us feel uncomfortable. And so we kind of stiff arm it, and we take a step back, and we don't know how to step towards it. And I think just allowing ourselves to be uncomfortable enough to crawl into that dark space with our friends that are hurting and do our best to try to share in their pain. That's what true empathy is. It's sharing in each other's pain. And when we can truly share in each other's pain, then that pain is lifted, you know, and they can be relieved maybe for a minute, and they can feel like they are not alone and that you really are in it with them.
Having loved someone as much as you loved Andrew and as you do now in sharing his story, how do you know when you'll be ready to maybe love somebody else? Because I think for everyone who loses someone close to them, that step where you move on and maybe enter into some kind of new relationship, I feel like that's a really difficult phase of the journey. How do you feel about that?
I think that's something that's unique to everybody. And I think, you know, we all have our own unique journeys on that. And for some people, it happens fast, and that's their journey. There's no judgment. There's no criticism. Like, some people get remarried within 3 months or 6 months or a year, and that's their journey. And that doesn't mean that they didn't fully love their person. But their person died. And so they're choosing to rebuild a new life. And so I think for me, you know, that's not the goal for me. The goal for me is not remarriage and, you know, finding that father figure for my kids and finding love again. Like, that's not the goal for me. The goal for me is to keep just being right in the center of God's will for my life. And if that's what God calls me to, wonderful. That's going to be a beautiful gift, and I can't wait. But if God calls me to singleness and to being a widow and to being a single mom, that's wonderful. Like, I can't wait to do that work too. And so for me, just on my journey, that's not a goal for me. If that happens, that's going to be absolutely amazing, and I'll be so grateful. But for other people, maybe it is, you know, maybe it is their goal to go find love again. And maybe they just deeply love love. You know, I've met other widows that just love love. Like, they just want to be in love, and they think love is beautiful, and they just love love. And that's beautiful too, you know? So I think respecting each individual journey and not judging and not criticizing, because if you have not lost a spouse, then you truly have no idea what it's like to move forward with your grief and move forward with your pain and defiantly choose to build a new life, you know, despite the great, great loss. So I think cheering each other on in those, if you have a friend that lost a spouse and a month later they're on Tinder and going on a date, like, cheer them on, you know, cheer them on and celebrate that. Like, they're being brave. They're being courageous. That's their own journey. So I think just celebrating our friends and celebrating those journeys and just being so gracious with each other. And we just always going back to, I have no idea what it's like to walk in anybody else's shoes but my own.
Well, Kayla, thank you so much for sharing your story with us so beautifully, and for bringing a book into the world that absolutely has come from difficult circumstances, to say the least, but I think is going to be such an encouragement to so many. So thank you, Kayla, for your time today. It really means a lot.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you for being brave with me and having this conversation.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.